The issue of whether the civilians in Gaza are innocent or guilty is not really like the big issue in my mind. Meaning there are many people that have bad beliefs and bad ideas and harmful ideas, but they're not guilty unless they've actually done something, right? They've actually done an act, right? That makes them, let's say, a combatant, makes them a legitimate target. That's very significant. The question is really just much more of not innocent guilt, but on a realistic level, do we think that this group of people is going to create some form of civil society that can peacefully coexist with Israel? I think there's a lot of skepticism in Israel about that today. And that being the case, the idea of saying you're going to lose territory in one form or another, right, that we're not going to rebuild this territory, we're going to put conditions on it, whatever this is going to look like, is fair. But it's not because in people are guilty. It's because of the fact that we look at this situation and say it's not viable to give them a state in these circumstances.
I'm Scott Kahn, and this is the Orthodox Conundrum. This is the Orthodox Conundrum on JewishCoffeeHouse.com. I'm Scott Kahn. Ever since President Trump presented his plan, or his idea, as it's unclear how planned out this really is, about resettling the Arab population of Gaza, the Jewish world has been in an uproar. Very loud voices on both sides of the issue have been talking not so much about its feasibility, many are extremely skeptical that this could ever come to fruition, but about whether it's ethical. Some insist that this is nothing less than ethnic cleansing, with all the negative implications that that term contains, while others suggest that this is completely different, and that if starting a war of aggression has no long-term negative consequences for the aggressor, then nothing will ever act as an effective deterrent against further attempts at genocide of the Jewish people. This is only one of the ethical issues that has arisen in the weeks since the ceasefire, and I was honored to speak with Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody to hash out some of the major ethical and moral dilemmas presented by the current situation. Along with the question of population transfer, Rabbi Brody and I talked about leadership and the ethics of taking responsibility, the moral question of toppling a government during wartime, the propriety of exchanging Palestinian prisoners, many of whom have blood on their hands, for Israeli hostages, when it's right to start a war rather than to use diplomacy, how we can define victory in war, how we determine the innocence of civilians who support a terrorist government, even if they don't participate in its atrocities directly, and much more. We'll get to our conversation in a moment. First, remember to subscribe to the Orthodox Conundrum podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate it and write a review. Continue the conversation on Facebook by joining the Orthodox Conundrum discussion group. Subscribe to my Substack, Orthodox Conundrum Commentary. Check out the link in the description of this podcast to get your free subscription today. Finally, in 2025, the best way to promote your organization, your business, or yourself is to create a high-quality podcast, and JCH Podcast Productions can help you make that happen. Whether you want to learn how to start your own podcast or want to improve the podcast you already produce, we will make it happen. Write to us at aliza@jewishcoffeehouse.com. That's aliza@jewishcoffeehouse.com, and let's get started with your high-quality, memorable, and effective podcast. Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody is the executive director of Ematai, an organization dedicated to helping Jews navigate aging, end-of-life care, and organ donation by providing educational resources, halachic guidance, and advanced planning tools. Previously a senior rebbe at Yeshivat HaKotel, he is a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, and his writings have appeared in many popular and scholarly publications and were cited in Israeli Supreme Court decisions. He is the author of two award-winning books, Ethics of Our Fighters, A Jewish View on War and Morality, and A Guide to the Complex, Contemporary Halachic Debates, a National Jewish Book Award winner. A graduate of Harvard College, he received smicha from the Israeli Chief Rabbinate, an MA in Jewish Philosophy at the Hebrew University, and his PhD from Bar-Ilan University Law School. Rabbi Shlomo Brody, thank you very much for joining me again on the Orthodox Conundrum podcast.
So great to be back with you.
There are a lot of issues that are coming up in the world of ethics. We spoke about ethics about a year ago because of your book, Ethics of Our Fighters. Today we're going to speak about new issues that have come up in ethics in Jewish law in Israel because of current events in the aftermath of the recent ceasefire. I'd like to start with the issue that today we're recording on Thursday, everybody's talking about, which is President Trump's suggestion or policy movement that Gaza should be emptied out of its citizens temporarily or permanently. That's a different question. And something. That's something we don't know exactly what will happen afterwards. But let's talk about Jewish ethics regarding population transfer. Can you offer some insights?
Well, you know, it's hard to know exactly what President Trump really has in mind and how this could change. And I think that what's critical here, which I think is very interesting, is basically after 100 years of having a real conflict, what we usually call the Arab-Israeli conflict, or you call the Jewish-Palestinian conflict, President Trump is basically saying, this ain't going to work with having these populations between the river and the sea, particularly with regard to Gaza Strip. So it's a big game changer in terms of how people are thinking about talking about issues. With regard to population transfer in particular, obviously that's a very sensitive issue. Presumably, I think this is pretty clear, you know, he's not talking about violence, right? Violently moving people. He's not talking about killing people. Again, I don't know what he's talking about, but I certainly am not interested in talking about that, right? No one wants to be doing some form of what is usually called as ethnic cleansing, right? It's some form of way if you refer to it, or genocidal acts, or whatever it might be. No one has that on their minds, and no one in Israel is going to do that. So let's just be clear. Like, no one in Israel is going to do that. So, the whole phenomenon of people talking about that way, I think is inappropriate. The idea that I think we have to think about this is, well, what's the motivation? Why would you move a population? And we think about a lot of different contexts. For example, and obviously this is different, right? But just to give an example, you're going to have a city that gets flooded. Like, I grew up in Houston, Texas, a lot of floods. And at some point, people just say, like, it ain't working here to invest in this area, which is going to be flooded again. Okay. Now, it's not a parallel, but I want to stand. So you would say here, we want to move these people and say, because it's not working, this dynamic here, because of natural issues, of resources, of flooding, wherever it might be. This is obviously different, but here's the argument. The argument basically is, we're going to have two choices now. We rebuild Gaza, billions, billions of dollars, with no real clear political horizon for this to work out. And a good chance that, particularly if the fundamentalists continue to rule, which seems likely, or alternatively, that some puppet government comes in, but the fundamentalists are going to be able to manipulate the situation as well. Because it's not clear, even if Israel wanted to create a strengthened Palestinian Authority, wherever it might be, it's not clear that this is going to work at all. And then 10 years later, we're going to be back to destroying this, the whole place again because of another war. So in that respect, you could ask, okay, well, at this stage, maybe we should be offering people another solution. And in that respect, I think it's interesting to think about a general question, which is, before we get to population transfer, just asking a simple question, would people in Gaza, what do they actually think? Would they actually want to leave given this situation? We're not talking about the Palestinian aspirations, not about West Bank. We're just saying the people who have a realistic sense of what they're living in. How many of them would actually want to leave? We don't know that answer to that, particularly even in this war, because the Egyptians closed their border, didn't allow for refugees, something which, of course, we didn't do in Syria and civil wars, other places like this. And so I think that's an interesting question. Would they want to go to Egypt or Jordan? More likely, would they want to go to places in Europe, whether it's in Sweden or other locations? I think this is all, interesting questions. And that's about voluntary.
Right.
Right. Allowing people to move.
Now, voluntary transfer is obviously something very different. It's hard to see the ethical issue of giving people the option to leave someplace that they don't want to be. But once we're talking about mandatory transfer, it's different.
Just to interrupt you for a minute, though, the idea of suggesting that we're going to make it easier for people to voluntarily leave because they don't see this as being good for them was seen even during the Biden administration by various as horrible, right? The idea that we're going to let people out, force the Egyptians, this is undermining Palestinian aspirations in their right to, self-determination and all sorts of, ideas like this. And I think in that respect, though, we have to ask, well, do they want to have Palestinian self-determination aspiration in Gaza under these circumstances? Those who don't want to be a part of it should be allowed out of it. And people didn't want to talk about that previously. So I think it's interesting in that respect to speak about it, you know, in those terms now.
Okay, but what about mandatory transfer? What about when we don't give them a choice and say, you have to leave? And obviously, there's a very big difference between whether it's temporary or permanent. But regardless, telling people, you must leave here, what do you have to say about that in terms of the ethics of population transfer?
Well, I mean, it's very morally complex, to put it lightly, because how exactly do you go about doing that? Now, if you're saying to them, which I think is reasonable, which is to say, we're not investing billions of our dollars to rebuild this up, which is going to be a destructive place, and that's one thing. If you're basically saying to people, we're going to force you out by starving you or something like that, whatever it is, I think that's a different type of dynamic. Because you have to ask is, well, do the residents of such an area, have they done something to make them guilty to be forcibly moved? Right? In the same way you would think about, we forcibly take someone and put them in jail because they've committed a crime. Now, there's no doubt that, you know, I wouldn't have any problems like this with, say, Hamas terrorists, but those people don't really should be going off to some other country. They should be going to jail, right? They should be incarcerated, whatever it might be. So that's a different type of dilemma, right? But in the case of the average citizen, it's hard to say that you could force them to do it, but I do think it is appropriate and fair to say, we're not interested in rebuilding this area under these circumstances when it's just become a fundamentalist, place again, once again. And if that being the case, I think that's, you know, an interesting type of dynamic. But you got to take this seriously, right? If you're going to actually tell people, we're strongly encouraging you to move, it has to be a real alternative.
What you just said raises several issues. Let me raise one idea that I've heard people say. Apparently, people will often say, population transfer is not considered, and I'm talking about mandatory population transfer, enforced population transfer, is not a problem when it comes to Jews living, let's say, in 2005 in Gaza, or in the view of people who are looking forward to a Palestinian state on the West Bank, in a future population transfer of Jews out of the settlements in the West Bank. And that's considered understood, that a future Palestinian state cannot have any Jews in it, according to most understandings of what a Palestinian state in theory would look like. So why is population transfer, they ask, okay there, but not okay in a case like this? Now, one might argue that the difference is these settlements all arose after 1967. The counter argument would be yes, because once again, they were kicked out after 1948, and they're just rebuilding traditional areas that already belonged to them earlier. So let me present that to you.
I mean, you can make such a parallel. I don't find it to be entirely compelling because when we're talking about, let's say, leaving Gaza, or the disengagement plan, which was initiated by Israel for the sake of creating some form of separation for the Palestinians, right? So that is a type of, you can think that was a bad move, you think that was wrong, but that was done by a government, my sovereign government, who made that decision. Right or wrong, that was sort of a decision being made here. It's one thing to impose on your own people, it's another thing to impose it on others. And particularly when not at their initiation, right? If there's some form of peace agreement, so you understand, there have been many times when we've had population swaps over the centuries, even the 20th century, and people move when we realize the borders need to be drawn differently. This isn't quite, I mean, again, I don't know exactly what Trump is talking about, but that's not quite the same here. It's sort of clearing out the area. And then there's this ambiguity, like, are they coming back? The Riviera, you know, or the Middle East, or the Gazan Riviera, whatever he called it, like, you know, I don't know, is that like a hotel he's got in mind? You know, so there's a lot of details here which are very important to figure out in terms of. So, you know, the parallel, I think, is more interesting is in the West Bank. The parallel is when Jews were kicked out of Arab lands in 1951. Right, there was 1950-51, you know, Iraq and Yemen, all these other places. But let's just remember, that was a horrible thing. That was an absolutely terrible, horrible thing that really, you know, can't be justified. I mean, the state of Israel is better for it. We brought people in and kibbutz goliot and whatever it might be, but that's a terrible action. So, and obviously in that case, they weren't helping the Jews resettle in Israel, right? No one in Iraq or Yemen was paying for that. So, you know, I think there's a lot of details on this, but I think it's really premature. Let's first start off at asking ourselves, what would Palestinians in Gaza, if they actually had a choice, what would they actually want to do? So in that respect, I think it's an interesting conversation. You know, Trump is like a paradigm breaker. He breaks all conventions for better, for worse. I have a lot of concerns about some of the things he does, but you know, opening up. But we have to be very careful like that. It becomes very easy for these types of plans and ideas to trickle down to unnecessary or unjustified violence. We should be wary of that.
Yes, I told my wife last night that my metaphor is this. Trump is like a two-year-old in Tiffany's, and I'm the owner of Tiffany's. And I don't remember if I underinsured the merchandise or overinsured the merchandise. Something's going to get broken. And if it's underinsured, it's going to be a disaster. And if it's overinsured, I'm going to make a lot of money. I'm not quite sure which way it's going to go, but something's going to get broken in the process.
Right. But your parallel, I mean, I get the joke. I mean, you make it as a humor, but the parallel is this isn't just about money here.
Of
right?
course.
You talk about tariffs, right? Yeah. But this is talking about something a little bit much right. more at stake.
So, absolutely.
But you know, this idea, though, which I think is horrible, and this is on an ethical, moral level, not just a strategic. We can launch on October 7th, and then the end result is people come back and say, oh, you know what? We really should give you guys a state. Or you know what? We should really rebuild this. Like, no, there actually has to be real consequences to what Hamas did in Gaza. I mean, the whole idea, for example, that there's pushback, you know, Israel can't create like a bit of a security, you know, no man zone within Gaza, right? No entry zone type of thing. We can't build something. I feel like you're taking Palestinian territory. Yes, when you start a war, unjustified war, and kill mass of our people, you lose and you lose territory afterwards. That is how war works. And that's how you stop people from launching these types of wars.
But isn't it true that in the international configuration of 2025, that's not really how war works anymore? It seems to me that after World War II, there was a general agreement among at least the Western powers and basically the world that we're no longer going to allow forcible takeover of territory, regardless of who started the war. That's why, for example, we have such problems with Israel, not only because of Palestinian national aspirations, but in the West Bank and Gaza, someone else started a war, but Israel taking over that territory. Let's say, for example, from the Golan, Israel annexed that territory, even though Syria technically on a legal level started the war. Israel annexed the Golan and the world has said ever since 1981, with the recent exception of the United States, that's not a valid annexation. It's not your territory. So is what you're saying really true?
Well, a lot of the issues of post-World War II are dealing with also imperialism, right? In terms of we're not going to build another empire. We're not replacing the Ottoman Empire with the British Empire like we did after World War I. We want to create some form of democratic societies. If anyone thinks that they're going to be building democratic societies in Gaza right now, you know, let me know, because you're just living in la-la land. I mean, this is sort of the mistake of Oslo and some of the premises behind this. And so in that respect, you have to have some form of the solution. Now, what's the solution of mine? So is it pushing back on territories, creating security borders? Is it some form of peace agreements with the Saudi Arabians? And there's a lot of different ways in which you can create some form of peaceful living arrangements. But sometimes that includes territory, right? The territory has to be taken over. Israel did that in the Golan, rightly so. Israel might be doing that in the Syrian Golan right now. And I think there's a justification for that. I actually think that is perfectly justified in terms of that because of the real threat that comes from Syria. The reason why this is complicated in, let's say, the West Bank is because of the fact that you're dealing with human beings, so that you're controlling and you have to have some form of political horizon of what is it that they're getting towards? How are they going to live?
Okay, Rabbi Brody, when you said before, when you start a war, an unjustified war, then you deserve to lose territory, that leads to the question of who the you is. So for example, in World War II, we had the Nazis, Nazi Germany, starting wars with almost all their neighbors. And essentially, we could say the Nazis were voted in by the German people. Admittedly, at the beginning, it wasn't a majority. And by the time it was a majority, the Nazis didn't allow for free elections. So we can never really know how many people in Germany were Nazi supporters. However, it was a very large percentage, even at the beginning. Now, when it comes to Gaza, people often, it seems to me, internationally treat it as though those people who are anti-Hamas, Hamas is this foreign entity that imposed itself upon the innocent citizens and civilians of Gaza, and therefore you have several thousand terrible people and 2 million innocent victims, meaning Palestinian victims of Hamas. A lot of people in Israel realize and would say that's absurd, that Hamas was voted in. Admittedly, there was also a civil war, so it wasn't as simple as everyone voted them in. But I'd like to understand better how we define innocent civilians when it comes to governments that are at least partially chosen by those people. And those governments are known to be murderous in their intentions.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's think about this. This gets related to the ethics of what they call the post-war situation, right? There's the post-bellum, right? There's no war, and now there are ethics about how you resolve these issues. And, you know, like what I said earlier is that it doesn't mean you have to lose territory. It means you can lose territory. And part of the reason why you can lose territory is because of the fact that we don't have an arrangement on the ground in which we can ensure some form of peaceful coexistence and resolution moving forward. Now, in the case of Germany, it's an interesting example, or Japan for that matter, right, as well. I mean, that's very significant, of course, when you think about World War II. The thought was, is that we have to remove those who are threats and continue to be threats. And the belief was that once that threat is removed, there can be a redeemed, some form of population, civic arrangement, a government, which can be peaceful. And that was the thought. And in some ways, it was a bit of an experiment, but keeping in mind that the feeling was that we could actually do this and accomplish this, and we didn't need to conquer territory for that. And that was what happened here. The question is, in parallel, do we see this happening in Gaza? And now, I am very much a believer in the idea that it is not predetermined that anyone's a terrorist, or anyone's anti-Semite, anything along these lines. I think that's a part of our belief in a free will. And we have many examples of this, right? People in Gaza and other places as well who recognize this. But you have to ask is, do we have a situation right now where there's a viable political setup where you think that everyone said, we don't think this can work anymore. We have to coexist with the Jews. I don't see any reason to think that right now. So that's what it really comes down to. The issue of whether the civilians in Gaza are innocent or guilty is not really like the big issue in my mind. Meaning there are many people that have bad beliefs and bad ideas and harmful ideas, but they're not guilty unless they've actually done something, right? They've actually done an act, right? That makes them, let's say, a combatant, makes them a legitimate target. That's very significant. The question is really just much more of not innocent guilt, but on a realistic level, do we think that this group of people is going to create some form of civil society that can peacefully coexist with Israel? I think there's a lot of skepticism in Israel about that today. And that being the case, the idea of saying you're going to lose territory in one form or another, right, that we're not going to rebuild this territory, we're going to put conditions on it, whatever this is going to look like, is fair. But it's not because people are guilty. It's because of the fact that we look at this situation and say it's not viable to give them a state in these circumstances.
Then let me ask you, because I mentioned a few moments ago the question of what the international order would think about that, because it's now considered somewhat verboten to take territory, even, again, if you didn't start the war. So ethically speaking, how do we look at international law? And the reason, Rabbi Brody, I'm asking this particularly, is because on the whole, international law is very important. As the war has progressed over the past 16 months, I've often thought that some of those rules in certain situations, at least the way people understand them, are, if not quite anachronistic, they don't necessarily apply to a war between basically a terrorist group and a country. Those were designed for wars between countries and between armies. And in an asymmetrical war, asymmetrical in both directions, the rules just don't make sense in some ways. So to what degree would we say international law as a concept has, I guess I'd say, religious or halakhic validity? And how about these international laws?
So I think international law has political importance. Its ethical importance is zero. And because the fact that it's law doesn't make it ethical. And the fact that it's law doesn't mean that's going to be ethically applied in the given circumstances for various political reasons. Now, I'm not saying that all international law is unethical. What I'm saying is that in order for an international law to have ethical value and meaning, it has to justify itself in terms of the content of what it stands for and what it means to execute in practice and not just in theory. There is a halakhic discussion a bit about, you know, well, will we be bound by international legal standards? And maybe the concept of dina de malchuta dina, as Rabbi Israeli or Shaul Israeli suggested at one point. Maybe this idea that the law of the land is binding in halacha would apply to international law as well. But given how international law has become so corrupted in a lot of different ways and deeply politicized, it has political importance, so we have to deal with this, the ICC and other factors, but it has zero ethical importance in my mind. And part of that's because of the hypocrisy of how it's applied. Is anyone dealing with international law when it comes to the Syrian civil war? Is anyone going to deal with the Russians because of this and many other conflicts? So if you're only going to apply it to the Jews and maybe some African nations, you're racist, anti-Semitic, but it's not an ethical legal system.
Okay, let's move on to something else now. One of the big issues that we're thinking about and praying for is the release of our hostages. And tragically, I say literally tragically, the only way we've been able to have them released is by releasing literal murderers back into the streets of Gaza, the streets of the West Bank, the streets of Jerusalem, and other countries. What are the ethics of prisoner swaps of that sort?
Well, I think if you look at the pictures of seeing these released hostages coming home, being reunited with their family, and you don't cry, and you don't have a heart. And if you see these pictures of these released murderers and terrorists going back to Gaza or East Jerusalem or the West Bank, wherever it might be, and being celebrated and paraded around as heroes, and you don't realize that that's harmful and dangerous, you don't have a mind. And I think that's in many ways a bit of the conflict that we have here. I'm not a big fan of how Israel has led itself over the past 40-something years, sort of create assumptions about prisoner swaps that have really just allowing the next generation of Hamas and terrorist leaders rest in jail for a little bit and come out. I mean, this is crazy. What type of message does that send? We have people that we rearrested after the Shalit deal and now get released again. That is like really literally saying there are minimal limited consequences to trying to murder Jews. That's a real disaster. And so this whole phenomenon that we're making these deals is really, really bad. In my mind, in fact, I'm much happier to stop the war and say, okay, whatever it is, we're stopping the war to get back our hostages than to release the terrorists from jails. Because in terms of thinking long-term for our security, it's much more dangerous in many ways, I think, long-term, to releasing all of these terrorists than is to stopping the war at this stage of the war, at least, which we might get into later on. You know, that said, if you ask me, are you against the deal? Well, you know, the question is always, what are the options on the table? What's available? What's the horizon here? I do think that despite the fact that I think that Israeli society, both our political leadership and our population, have overly promoted this idea of having responsibility of bringing people home. Of course, it's important. Of course, it's important. But the question is, at what cost? There is a very strong moral argument to say that deals have to be done because Israeli solidarity is dependent on it. And in that respect, we need to think long and hard about what creates solidarity and what has made it possible for us to fight this war relatively successfully in horrific conditions, having all these people in reserves leaving their families and falling in war, losing limbs, and all the spouses and children grappling with it one form or another. And a lot of that has to do with the solidarity and camaraderie of our society. And so in that respect, there can be a justification, I think, to saying we need to get this done. We need to get these people home. But we have to be thinking about what those consequences and dangers are of releasing these terrorists. When the army says, we'll know how to deal with it, I really find that embarrassing. Like, you didn't know how to deal with it in the past. And it's not really clear how you know how to deal with it. So, like, have a little bit more modesty about this.
Meaning dealing with the new terrorists who've been released.
Exactly. There's like, we're releasing, a couple thousand people here. And by the way, people make a big phenomenon of the people that had blood on their hands are actually murderers. Sinwar is in jail previously. He didn't have blood on his hands, actually. There are many people that never were successful, but they're going to be successful in the future. And so one of the things we need to think about is, okay, how do we deal with this long term And it's not just about thinking long-term in terms of dealing with Hamas, it's dealing with a larger geopolitical situation. So, you know, in that respect, I think it's possible to justify this deal. If I was on in the cabinet, which I'm sort of happy I wasn't, the fact that I came to this, you know, I could understand some of why people support it. I really feel the biggest moral failure was October 10th or 11th or 12th, when Netanyahu should have gone up and said, I made a mistake with the Shalit deal. And Yair Lapid, who is the head of the opposition, who after the Shalit deal in 2015 publicly said we can never make such a deal like this. And so we should have legislation prohibiting it, which I totally support, to have this lopsided deal. Yair Lapid should have had the moral leadership to say, Bibi, tell everyone we're not going to do this again. I'm going to back you. But neither of them have the moral leadership in my mind to deal with that.
Would you say there's a difference when it does come to prisoner swaps? Again, speaking in terms of Jewish ethics, between soldiers and civilians, I'm speaking about Israeli soldiers versus Israeli civilians, because there's a general assumption that civilians come first, soldiers put themselves into that situation because they're soldiers. It's a different situation. When you put on that uniform, you are saying, my life is now at risk and I accept that responsibility. On the other hand, in a country like Israel with a mandatory draft, they didn't have a choice but to put on that gun to wear that uniform. So maybe there isn't such a difference.
Yeah, I'm not so sure there's such a big difference. I mean, the difference in priority comes down to the idea that in general in war, we prioritize our civilians over our soldiers, because the whole reason to go to war, to make such risks, is to, you know, save the, protect the civilians. But because of the mandatory conscription, and because of the fact that there are agents, we send them out there, right? These soldiers, I don't buy the whole argument there's such a large difference about it. What I do think is very different is whether you're bringing home someone alive or dead. Meaning the idea of making prisoner swaps in order to bring someone home alive is compelling to me, is cogent to me. Now, it's compelling, but certainly cogent. This idea of risking long-term security to bring someone home for their funeral, I think is very, very problematic.
You just mentioned Prime Minister Netanyahu and the head of the opposition, Yair Lapid, which leads us to the question about leadership and the ethics of responsibility. One of the most frustrating things for someone like me and for many people who live in Israel has been the refusal of many in the political echelon to take responsibility. Recently, we saw that members of the IDF did take responsibility. There have been some people in the government who have taken responsibility, but by and large, the ruling government has taken no responsibility whatsoever. People like Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's essentially said, we'll deal with that later, and has acknowledged no wrongdoing. I don't even mean moral wrongdoing. I mean mistakes in his security assumptions, which obviously were mistaken. We now understand mistakes on October 7th. And of course, that's true for so many other people there. Ben-Gvir was the head of the police force, and the police also failed, but he refuses to take responsibility. Everyone is simply passing the buck, and there's no concept of, in Harry Truman's words, the buck stops here. I'd like to know a little bit about the ethics of taking responsibility and, alongside that, perhaps the ethics of toppling the government during a war, which the government itself says this is not the time for that because that will hurt the war effort.
Well, I think there's a difference between responsibility and punishment, right? And what I mean by that, this is true in general. There are many times we say responsible, but the punishment is a little bit different depending on the circumstances. The idea that you're the prime minister or the defense minister, and you're going to say that I don't have responsibility because the army, which was advising me, didn't see this coming or messed up. Like, that's a flawed conception of what it means to be the prime minister or the defense minister. So that, in my mind, is very, very deeply problematic. And this idea of saying, you know, that, and again, it's not really clear what Netanyahu actually thinks about this. He hasn't really talked about it. You know, he's made some references to it. And a lot of this all has to do with like politics, and he doesn't want to admit anything that would make it come down to the punishment, meaning, do I have to leave office? And here I do think there's a difference between IDF officers and elected officials. Elected officials, you can say, the people are going to decide whether or not this person should be out of office or not. And that works differently for the IDF based on how they got into their position of power. So I think that one of the questions that's really interesting is that the whole notion of needing some form of national investigation, of course we need that. Like, it's insane that anyone would think otherwise, and it's a moral travesty that October 10th, the first thing that should have been done is an investigation of prisoner swaps. That should have been done right away. We don't even have official statistics publicly released But how many people were let go on the Shalit deal or other deals went back to terror? That's crazy. The whole public discourse has been totally jarred and jaded because we don't have that. So that's a moral travesty that someone would suggest we don't have to do a proper investigation. There's a separate question, which I think is an interesting one, is, and what are the powers of those bodies? Like, should it be headed by a judge? A judge implies a judgment of innocent or guilty and making decisions about whether they have to leave office or not. I'm not so sure that's the way you have to set up the national investigation. And that's not totally clear to me, unless there's something so egregious in terms of being criminal, right? Something along those lines, which I find hard to believe in this circumstance. But, you know, the idea of having responsibility, well, listen, we look in the Torah. We have notions of a Nisim, of leaders, all right, of Melech and others who have to bring a korban. It's a very significant passage in Sefer Vayikra, which we should talk a lot about. And this idea of saying we want to live in a type of society in which our leaders can take responsibility for their actions.
I mean, I think about the Meiron issue when there was that disaster in Meiron a few years ago, after which there was a commission of inquiry, which came out and listed people by name saying who was responsible and what they did wrong. And no one cares. The government didn't fall. Those individuals in the government went unpunished. And I mean, literally unpunished. There was actually probably criminal activity there because criminal negligence, I should say. And the question is, once you have a commission of inquiry, if no one does anything about it, if it has no teeth, on some level, what's the point?
Right. So I do agree. I mean, that's an interesting question, that parallel. That might be a little bit different in terms of having a very isolated type of situation and depending on what you can say. In other words, if someone would say that what they're going to find is, we were told you very explicitly, do not do this, it's a danger. And you said, I know it's a danger, I don't care.
Which is what happened there.
Exactly. So that is the type of situation where I could see where teeth would be appropriate there, because otherwise the political situation is not going to take care of it on its own. But if it's the type of situation where bad judgment calls were made, reasonable bad. I mean, listen, what we know already about October 6th, the night of October 6th, beginning of October 7th, we know now, it's been pretty public, that the war warnings within the IDF went all the way up, who felt like, you know, we've seen this before, right? And that was a bad judgment call. And there's a lot to be saying about this, but I'd be hard to press to say that that's a judgment call that mandates someone to leave who has been politically elected. You know, I have a hard time seeing that, but maybe it is. But then we have to very clearly define what this looks like.
I suppose that part of the issue, and I don't want to get too far afield, is that in Israel, because the legislative and executive branches are not separate, therefore it's very difficult to have any sort of impeachment process. In the United States, by contrast, Congress and the Senate, they are separate, at least officially, from the executive, and therefore they can at least in principle sit in judgment on the executive branch, on the president. Here, that wouldn't make any sense even.
Yeah, that's a good point. Of course, in the background here is the toxic relationship between the judiciary and the executive branch. And that's caused a lot of damage in a lot of different ways. And this is another one of those ramifications for it.
Let's get back to that other question I mentioned before, the ethics of toppling a government in the middle of war. The current government has said that would be extraordinarily irresponsible. And the question is that really true? And I'm not asking for a political answer. I'm asking more for a moral answer. If we say that the government, for example, is responsible for what happened on October 7th, let's work with that assumption, even if it may not be true in some people's eyes. But for the sake of argument, that the assumption, the conception, as they say, what they had assumed before October 7th was completely false, and therefore this government bears responsibility for it, and we should topple the government and have new elections. The government says that's ridiculous to do during a war. You're going to hurt the war effort itself. What do you think ethically?
I don't think that's an ethical issue per se. The question isn't about it's not about punishment. It's about thinking moving forward. At that point, October 10th, what was the best thing for moving forward? Was it to get rid of the chief of staff at that point? You could have made such an argument, by the way. I mean, it seems a little bit crazy, but you can make such an argument that that was what was necessary. We had to actually do that, or various other, you know, members of intelligence or whatever it might be. But, you know, I think we have to think moving forward. I mean, think about England. It changed prime ministers after the war broke out. There are many times we have situations, I think during the American Civil War, if I'm not mistaken, Lincoln changed his chief of staff like four times, right? So that can definitely happen. And a healthy democracy isn't dependent on one person, right? That's the whole point of the system, right? Someone else can be able to step into those shoes and be able to deal with those issues. I mean, what would have happened if Netanyahu, that young man, right, had died suddenly, chas v'shalom, right? I think we've had to replace it, right? That would happen. So this idea of saying that's unfathomable. And I do think that there's a moral concern that those who are responsible one form or another for some form of mishap or mistakes will make further mistakes in order to atone or make up for the decisions they made. For example, you could argue that one of the reasons why various people in the army were very strongly in favor of prisoner swaps is they felt moral guilt for their failure as having brought these people into captivity. And that might have, you know, biased their judgment, or it could be that actually that just means that they took it seriously. Hard to know. I don't see this as something which is clearly morally appropriate or inappropriate.
Okay. Before, you talked about the end of the war, defining victory. So I'd actually like to ask about that from your perspective, Rabbi Brody. When we talk about the morning after plan, what's going to happen when this is all over, how actually is victory in war defined? Because you're someone who's written a lot about the ethics of warfare. And one of the things that has been frustrating to me has been people saying, oh, Hamas won. Now, maybe you'll say that's true. In my mind, this is a war between Israel and Iran, not Israel and Hamas. Hamas is simply the representative, so to speak, the shaliach of Iran here. And if you look at where everyone was on October 6th, 16 months ago, where everyone is now, meaning Iran, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Hamas, and Israel on the other side, and you see who is better off and who's worse off, I don't think you can argue that Iran won this war or even that Hamas won this war. On the other hand, if Hamas defines winning as we're still here, and personally, I think Bibi Netanyahu made a big mistake on day one by saying we will destroy Hamas, which is, I think, an almost impossible task. He didn't say we're going to destroy their military. We're going to destroy Hamas altogether. So they can define victory however they want. We're still here. We have one Hamas member. So therefore, you lost based on your own definition. Now, let me be clear. I understand this isn't the Super Bowl where we have to say they won and they lost, and that's an essential part of it. No one really cares. That's not really what it's about. At the same time, people do discuss wars in terms of who's victorious and who's not. I'm kind of curious about how you understand that. So maybe you can help me. How do you define victory in a situation like this?
Well, I think the biggest question you have to ask is, what's the significance of defining victory? On a political level, those who can feel victorious, of course, that can have sort of political significance. The fact that Hamas can say, we caused all this harm and survived, and at least publicly, people can say, okay, great job, you know, like you guys did it, right? You made it, is problematic. But on a moral level, I don't think that's really a very interesting question. The more interesting question is, what are you going to war for? What are you trying to accomplish? Given being realistic of the situation that you have, given the cost and benefits of a war, that's really the most important question. It's not like, you know, are we going to have a military parade at the end? And so in that respect, one of the things I think we have to ask is, well, given the war, maybe whatever Netanyahu, how he defined it and bringing home all the hostages and, you know, feeding Hamas was over exaggeration and politically, you know, in some ways astute, but otherwise very problematic. I'm not interested in that question. I'm really interested in the question of, are we in a better place in terms of our defense moving forward? Are we more safe or less safe? Now, I think right now, I'm not sure the answer to that question. I think a lot of that has to do with, where is this all going in terms of the ongoing conflict, not just in Gaza or Lebanon, but in the region, and particularly with Iran. And in that respect, I think that's the more interesting question right now. When we look back from October 6th to whenever we say this is over, right now, are we safer? Are we more secure? Do we have a better short-term or long-term future or not? That's the question you should be asking right now. And in that respect, I agree with you, Scott, that this is an ongoing conflict right now. We have a ceasefire. We've not stopped. But I think that the big question we should have to be asking is, what actions would need to be taken right now that are going to secure us better? Is it continuing the war, restarting the war in Gaza? That's unclear to me, you know, especially given the politics of what Trump is talking about right now. I'm not sure if that's really true. I do think, though, that we have a real fear of the Iranian nuclear reactors and Iran feeling weakened and them then possibly racing towards a bomb. And if we end up having this whole experience, having weakened a lot of their proxies, but then they race to the bomb and no one stops them, well, we're going to walk away feeling not more secure, right? In fact, less secure. So in that respect, we have to be very, sort of calculative about what it is that we're trying to accomplish. And victory just doesn't interest me that much. Of course, it's politically significant, but not morally.
Then morally, I think an issue really is, however, when you decide to use a military versus a political solution. You just mentioned now the big question, which everyone is thinking about, should Israel resume the war once they release X number of hostages, whatever that number is, all of them, some of them? How do you determine on an ethical level when it's justified to go to war versus when it's justified only to use more political means to achieve your goals?
So you go to war. At the beginning of war, you have to ask, given the cost and benefits, right, does this make sense? You started the war on October 7th or 8th, meaning responded, right, because you're under attack. At different stages, you can say, is this now still a situation of war of no choice? We have to do this? Or is that a war of choice? I think we're at a point where the war in Gaza is a war of choice. We have a choice. What do we think we can accomplish in the coming months in war or outside of war, which will be more effective? I'm personally pretty skeptical that we're going to accomplish much more than we've done in the last 15 months. It's not clear to me that's going to happen for military reasons, for political reasons, because the country's exhausted, for all sorts of reasons. I'm not sure about whether that's really going to accomplish much. Obviously, I don't know all the full facts on the ground in terms of what we know and don't know, but I'm skeptical. I'm much more interested in dealing with the Iranian threat, which isn't just about their nuclear weapon, but is weakening them to the point where their proxies aren't able to rearm in the same way and have the same type of political and military strength. It's both dealing with Iran and their proxies. So what I'm sort of hinting at and saying explicitly right now is I hope that we're deeply thinking about whether we can eliminate the nuclear threat and also weaken that regime so that way we feel at the end of this process we're in a much safer place. If Israel walks away from this whole period, it's a very difficult period, and we've significantly weakened Hamas and Hezbollah, Syria has fallen, we have a peace agreement with Saudi Arabia, we have weapons from the United States, and we've taken out the nuclear reactors in Iran, well, I'll feel pretty good about all that we've accomplished in spite of the painful losses and all those that we've lost from our cherished ones.
All right. Well, Rabbi Shlomo Brody, I really appreciate your offering your wisdom and helping work through some of these issues. Some of them lean into the political, and I try to keep as much as possible on the level of ethics and morals, and you kept me there as well. So I appreciate it. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much. And I wanted just to say to everyone, it's so important to always try to be level-headed about these issues and to think about the ethics of what we're doing. And, it's exciting when you hear about someone talk about Gaza or war, this or that. Let's take a deep breath, look to our Torah, look to our values, and analyze these situations.
And if I can just say one more thing, and you can tell me if I have this correctly. In our last conversation, you mentioned how important it is to say, well, if someone did that to you, would you consider that ethically okay? And if the answer is no, then you can't do it to the other, even if that other is your enemy. Is that a true statement?
Yeah, ethics works because you think it applies to others as well, you and others as well. So this is something which is very important in terms of thinking about the dilemmas that we're facing today.
Okay, Rabbi Brody, thank you very much. Subscribe to the Orthodox Conundrum podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and please rate it and write a review. Please visit JewishCoffeeHouse.com for other episodes of the Orthodox Conundrum, as well as many other great podcasts, including Intimate Judaism, The Maimonides Minute, Chochmat Nashim, The Francisca Show, and Let My People Eat. I'd appreciate it if you go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review The Orthodox Conundrum. It takes literally 2 minutes. It's just giving a certain number of stars and writing one or two sentences. Please like The Orthodox Conundrum podcast on Facebook and join our growing Facebook group, The Orthodox Conundrum Discussion Group, where you can feel free to discuss issues in Orthodoxy in an honest and friendly environment. I hope you'll become a Jewish Coffeehouse patron on Patreon. Just click on the link in the description of this podcast, and you can get bonus episodes, Jewish Coffeehouse merch, and more. you'll get special episodes on all sorts of topics that are only available to subscribers. And you'll be helping Jewish Coffee House spread our message of a welcoming, intellectually engaged, and honest orthodoxy. Just join Patreon. It's only a couple of dollars a month, and you can stop anytime, so join today. Finally, do you have a message that needs to get out? Do you want to promote your business, your organization, or your cause? The best way is by producing a podcast, and Jewish Coffee House can make it happen. I have experience producing hundreds of podcasts, both for myself and for satisfied clients. Whether you want to learn everything you need in one day, or relax and record and let me do the heavy lifting, Jewish Coffee House Productions will work with you to make it happen and make it even better than you imagined. Let me help you today. Write to me at scott@jewishcoffeehouse.com or go to jewishcoffeehouse.com, click on Productions, and sign up for a free consultation. Make your voice heard, promote your cause, sell your product, and engage an audience now. I'm Scott Kahn. This has been the Orthodox Conundrum on JewishCoffeeHouse.com.